seated. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Thomas v. Long.
May it please the court, Mr. Michael R. Holmes will present argument from petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. My name is Michael Holt. I'm assistant Harris County attorney, and I represent Petitioner Tommy Thomas in his official capacity in this case. This case brings to you two issues. Both are jurisdictional. The first jurisdictional issue was whether the trial court properly denied its own jurisdiction when it said that Sheriff Thomas couldn't appeal under 51.014A8, which allows an interlocutory appeal.
Did the trial court properly?
The Court of Appeals, if I said that, pardon me, Your Honor. The second jurisdictional question, under which we have three arguments, basically asks whether the trial court had jurisdiction to enter the orders. It did, basically under the respondent's declaratory judgment claim. With regard to the first issue, as I said, an interlocutory appeal is available when the trial court grants or denies a plea to the jurisdiction by a governmental unit. That's 51014A8 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code. There's no dispute here that, I don't believe there's any dispute here, that Sheriff Thomas did in fact raise jurisdictional issues in his motion for partial summary judgment. As a matter of fact, it dominated the motion for partial summary judgment. And there's no dispute that the trial court granted relief, declaratory relief, to the respondent and also denied Sheriff Thomas's partial motion for summary judgment as it pertained to the jurisdictional issue.
Is there a difference between plea and bar and plea to the jurisdiction?
Not that I'm capable of telling you, Your Honor.
Well, the Court of Appeals says that a plea and bar results in a take-nothing judgment, whereas a plea to the jurisdiction results in dismissal, and your answer was a plea and bar. I'm just wondering if that makes any difference here.
Oh, actually, if I can amend something, Your Honor, the plea and bar asserted a primary jurisdiction argument. The exclusive jurisdiction argument was raised in the partial motion for summary judgment. A motion for partial summary judgment. So, in fact, that was an error in the brief. As I pointed out in the brief, there are four courts of appeals that have held that an appeal under A8 is permissible if it's brought in another form other than an actual plea to the jurisdiction. The courts basically hold, look to the substance, not to the title or the form of the motion or the plea. As well, there are three courts that go in the other direction. This court has said often, many times, to look to substance, not form. For example, in the case of Spear v. Stover, which I've cited in the brief, that was a case where in the trial court, the defendant filed a plea in abatement, claiming that the trial court didn't have jurisdiction. The trial court entered an order dismissing the case, saying, yeah, you're right, I don't have jurisdiction. The plaintiff took it up on appeal, and the Court of Appeals said, wait, that was a plea in abatement. A plea in abatement only results in, abatement as opposed to a dismissal, and therefore it's not a final order. This court said, no, look at what the motion actually, or the relief that was sought. What was sought was a plea to the jurisdiction, not a plea in abatement. Therefore, the order was final, and therefore the Court of Appeals should have addressed the issues.
Presuming that we agree with you on that point.
Yes, Your Honor.
As to the substantive jurisdictional question the Court of Appeals would consider, do you agree with the Court of Appeals' opinion that the only substantive issue relating to jurisdiction would be the exhaustion of remedies piece?
No, Your Honor. We have three arguments total with regard to...
Well, but the Court of Appeals said that those don't relate to jurisdiction.
I don't agree with that, Your Honor.
Well,
in particular, the Court of Appeals said that the Declaratory Judgment Act, if it were misapplied, was merely error. It's not a jurisdictional problem.
Right.
My contention is that Tommy Thomas was sued in his official capacity, a case brought against an official in his official capacity, the case against the government union. Therefore, the suit is still, the defendant still has a sovereign immunity. Sovereign immunity consists of two components, immunity from suit and immunity from liability. Tommy Thomas still has his immunity from suit. And under the Declaratory Judgment Act, if somebody tries to backdoor into something that's normally barred by sovereign immunity or immunity from suit, the Declaratory Judgment Act cannot provide relief and the jurisdiction is proper.
Well, now, the Court of Appeals said the sheriff's brief has not established that it's immune from suit. What does it mean by that?
Honestly, Your Honor, I'm not sure. Again, Tommy Thomas was sued in his official capacity, and he represents the governmental unit. The governmental unit, sovereign immunity is the rule. And
that was pled and alleged. So you don't know why the Court of Appeals made that statement.
I do not know why, Your Honor.
In fact, counsel, your client's been raised the same issue as to whether the interpretation of the commission's order could include that the claimant go back to work without any testing, and that's been decided by the First Court of Appeals in 2003. In a case that's almost directly on point, there is 2003 Shepherd versus Thomas. Decided in a footnote, but don't say a whole lot about it.
Shepherd was a case where the employee actually went back to the commission and asked for relief, which is one of our arguments, that the relief should have been granted in the commission. And Shepherd, the commission signed an order, and that order can be found, Your Honor, at record 223-224. Also, there's a case, a Van Pelt case in 1994, where someone was exempted from testing, and that's at page 229. Essentially, if people go back to the Civil Service Commission and they've asked for relief, at certain times the commission has given them relief from these testing requirements. And it's our contention that that's what should have happened in this case.
Well, in Shepherd, the court cites the commission's order that as, quote, Shepherd should be reinstated to his former rank as a deputy with seniority and benefits, but no reimbursement of back wages. Was there a modification of that order by the commission?
There's a subsequent
otherwise,
order.
Otherwise, that's the same order as in this case.
No, there was a subsequent order, and that's what you'll find at the record references.
Let me ask you also about the statute, 51.014A. You say that we should look at the substance of that statute rather than the specific vehicles or motions that are cited. The statute's fairly specific in different places. It cites specifically temporary injunctions and what you can do with those, motions for summary judgments, what you can do with those, motion to vacate an order appointing a receiver or trustee, what can happen with those. And then in A8, the relevant one here, it says plead to the jurisdiction. Why shouldn't we look at that whole section and say the legislature specifically pinpointed the motions it wanted to handle in certain ways and just rely on the strict language in A8? It says plea to the jurisdiction. Stay only pleas to the jurisdiction can be handled this way.
If I may answer by example, Your Honor, under A3, which allows an interlocutory appeal when a trial court certifies or refuses to certify a class, this court has held in the past in the McAllen Medical Center case that a preliminary certification of the class isn't an interlocutory appealable order in order to protect the rights of the class. This court has also held in the De Los Santos case that when a class type has changed significantly so as to alter the fundamental nature, that is basically creating a new class, and thus you can take another interlocutory appeal. Under A4, which allows...
Those examples under A3 are of a different nature than what we're talking about under A8, aren't they? We're still talking about certifying or refusing to certify a class, which, from what I understand, you've cited the opinions as saying they talk about at what point you can address that, not whether it's an actual class certification or not.
Well, actually, Your Honor, in McAllen, that was a preliminary certification. The certification had never taken place before the appeal. To give another example, under A4, the grants or refuses or grants a temporary injunction or grants or refuses to dissolve a temporary injunction. Despite a temporary injunction probably being void, this court held that the interlocutory appeal could be taken by the enjoined person. Also, that was in the Quest Communications case. Also in the Brown versus Todd case, this court held that a denial of standing is essentially denial of a temporary injunction, again, looking to what was intended behind the statute and allowing an interlocutory appeal. And finally, under A5, which allows an interlocutory appeal from a denial of a motion for summary judgment that's based on an assertion of immunity by an individual. This court has allowed in three different cases, the City of Beverly Hills case, the DeWitt case, and the City of Houston versus Kilburn case, allowed the governmental unit to take an interlocutory appeal when it's asserting the individual's immunity, despite the plain language of the statute appearing to allow only the individual to appeal. The point of all this is...
Remember those three cases?
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor. City of Beverly Hills versus Guevara, 904 Southwest 2nd, 655. DeWitt versus Harris County.
Okay.
904-650, and City of Houston versus Kilburn, 849, Southwest 2nd, 810. The point of this is, Your Honor, is the court has in the past looked at what the intent of the interlocutory statutes were. And while the interpretations don't necessarily follow the literal language of the statute, they certainly follow the spirit. Since these interpretations by the court have come out, these somewhat non-literal interpretations, the legislature has amended 510.14 twice in the last two sessions alone, and they've not monkeyed with any of those provisions. So apparently the legislature is happy with the court's interpretation as intended, not as specifically written. Regarding the jurisdictional problems in the trial court, Tommy Thomas asserts that there are three reasons why the trial court lacked jurisdiction to enter the orders as it did. First reason is Tommy Thomas asserts that the Civil Service Commission had exclusive jurisdiction. Under the exclusive jurisdiction doctrine, all relief should have been had through the Civil Service Commission rather than going through an independent or going through a collateral proceeding.
Whose burden was it? If you assume with me for a moment that the civil service order was silent on this question,
yes, Your Honor.
Then who had the burden to go clarify that if that question is within their exclusive jurisdiction?
The respondent did, Your Honor.
And why is that?
Because the regulations which Sheriff Thomas was trying to enforce were regulations that were in the employment manual that was issued to Ms. Long, that these regulations have been in place since at least 1994. There's record evidence that the affidavit by Major Henderson at 209 and 210, since at least 1996, the Sheriff's Department has required this of every employee who's gone on leave for military leave, FMLA, you name it. If they're gone for more than a year, they have to come back and take that testing. They've applied it to everyone. More importantly, of the testing requirements, all but one are required by state law. They're required by TCOS provisions in the Texas Administrative Code, which I cite in the brief, 37 Texas Administrative Code 217.78. So Tommy Thomas didn't make those regulations, and most of those regulations, the state did. The leading case on the exclusive jurisdiction doctrine, or the most recent case.
Which case, which order came first, the order in Shepherd or the order in this case, from the commission?
Shepherd, Your Honor.
And so at the time Thomas was before the commission in this adversarial hearing, they knew what the issue was. Why wouldn't Tommy Thomas have asked the commission to clarify its order to say whether or not pre-qualification testing was required? Just because he didn't have the burden? Because he didn't have the burden? He knew what the issue was.
I believe that's the case, Your Honor. Look, the Civil Service
just
Commission...
kind of a trap. You can go back into the district court and then you can send it back down to this order.
No, Your Honor. The employees are charged with knowing what's in the manual. And again, it's applied to everybody. Ms. Long had a pretty colorful disciplinary history in the Sheriff's Department, and she should have been aware of those provisions.
But this was a full adversarial hearing, yeah. And there's no question about whether or not she was qualified that was put in evidence. So why wouldn't Thomas, knowing what happened in the Shepherd case, the same procedurally, it happened the same way, except that Long didn't ask to go back down to the commission. But why wouldn't the sheriff have asked the commissioners to modify their order or clarify their order so that she would have to go through this testing?
Frankly, Your Honor, at the time we were fighting Shepherd, we lost. But it's our contention that, Shepherd did the right thing. He went and requested relief. He put the burden on himself, and he did it the right way, and he got the relief that way. Thomas didn't do that, and the commission didn't go out of their way to give him that relief.
But Sheriff Thomas sent a letter to the commission after the first order saying simply reinstate and said, I'm not going to follow it because he has to submit to these tests. It's at that point that the employee went back to the commission. So, again, following Justice Jefferson's question, Sheriff Thomas knew this was an issue with the commission with orders that simply said reinstate but no reimbursement of back wages. Couldn't the sheriff have raised it when it got the same order that it initially got in Shepherd?
I suppose he could, Your Honor, before the commission, but the commission is well aware of this regulation, and Jeannie Long is charged with being aware of this regulation.
As is the sheriff.
Oh, yeah, he promulgated it. But... you know, there's thousands of regulations, and, you know, you can't go around warning everybody before they do something. And we probably hear dozens, probably 50 to 100 civil service hearings a year. I mean.
Any other questions?
One other question. If the commission said or ordered the person to go back to work, but then the testing indicated that the person couldn't get their job back, then you have an inability to follow the commission's order?
Well, it depends, I guess, on the circumstances of why they couldn't complete the testing. If they couldn't comply with the state testing requirements, which are psychological tests, criminal background, drug testing, several other things, medical tests, if they couldn't comply with those, they're going to lose their license. They can't be a peace officer anyway. The only test remaining that Tommy Thomas has is the physical ability test, and while it's not in evidence, there are provisions where somebody who can't pass it can make it up at a later date, as it'll give them some time to work at it.
There is the potential that the testing could be used. I'm not saying it was here, but it could be used as a means of frustrating the commission's order.
Testing is applied across the board, whether somebody's being reinstated from a termination or somebody's coming back from guard duty. Everybody does it. Everybody always has.
I understand that. My question is, testing could be used as a method of frustrating the commission's order.
Since Shepard, if the commission were to order that...
Assume the commission didn't order that.
No. I mean, you're assuming a bad motive on behalf of Tommy Thomas, and I don't think that's...
Well, I said I'm not assuming it happened here. I'm saying, conceptually, hypothetically, testing could be used as a way to frustrate the commission's order.
I can't concede to that, Your Honor. I mean, that assumes that somebody in the Sheriff's Department wants to frustrate the commission. I don't see that happening.
Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Ajay Chowdhury will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. In preparing for oral argument, I realized that there's an important point that has not been addressed by either side in any of the briefs, and that's this. How is this interlocutory appeal affected by the fact that the sheriff has never challenged the trial court's jurisdiction over Jeannie Long's retaliation claim? Now, three courts of appeals have come to the same conclusion on this issue, and I'm aware of no court of appeals decision that's come to a different conclusion on this particular issue. I'll show you a quote from the case Harris County Flood Control District versus PG&E. Citation is 35 Southwest 3rd 772. It's a 2000 Houston First District case. In that case, the court held, quote, when the trial court has jurisdiction over any claim against a governmental entity, the court should deny that entity's plea to the jurisdiction, end quote. And the reasoning for this is twofold, really. One is that a plea to the jurisdiction is a plea designed to dismiss all the claims. So if a party is not trying to dismiss all the claims, they're not truly making a plea to the jurisdiction. So here, the sheriff never tried to dismiss Jeannie Long's retaliation claim. So the sheriff has truly never made a plea to the jurisdiction. The second point is that for policy reasons, the policy reason for allowing a party to pursue an interlocutory appeal is that if the party was not allowed to pursue an interlocutory appeal, then if it turns out that the party is immune from liability, the party will waste resources on a trial needlessly. That's the policy reason for allowing an interlocutory appeal. But that policy reason doesn't apply if there's going to be a trial anyways on another claim against that party, which is the case we have here. In other words, the retaliation claim is set for trial. They've never moved to dismiss it. There's going to be a trial on that claim anyways, regardless of what happens on this interlocutory appeal. So there's no policy reason for allowing this interlocutory appeal, because they're going to have to spend their resources on the trial anyways. And so these three courts, I've cited one case, two other courts of appeals have come to the same conclusion that interlocutory appeals should not be allowed in this type of case where trial court has jurisdiction over at least one claim against a governmental entity. So I cited the Houston First District case. There's a Waco Court of Appeals decision. It's a citation of 17 Southwest 3rd 260. That's a 2000 decision. And then there's a El Paso Court of Appeals case. Citation is it's a Lexis site, 2003 Tax App Lexis 10419. That's Life Management Center versus Christina Cruz. And the when we go back to the Waco case, that's called Aledo Independent School District versus Choctaw Properties.
Well, I understood that the back pay was not for the back pay while she was off the first time, but for the back pay after she refused to test. Is that wrong?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
You're saying that what is still left for trial?
Oh, the retaliation claim. Jeannie Long filed a charge of discrimination with the Texas Commission on Human Rights, saying that she was discriminated based on her gender because she's not being allowed to return to work. That claim is set for trial still. It's a retaliation claim. It's a discrimination claim, basically, saying that she's being retaliated against for filing a charge of discrimination.
But it stands or falls with the testing issue, right? I mean, if the sheriff has the right to make people, regardless of their gender, test after being gone for a year, then that claim goes away.
Yes, but the sheriff has never tried to dismiss the retaliation claim and has never challenged the trial court's jurisdiction over the retaliation claim.
But if the trial court doesn't have jurisdiction to decide the testing claim, how are they going to decide the other one?
Well, the jury is really the one who will... The trial court does have jurisdiction over the retaliation claim. I mean, that's clear. It's just under the Texas Commission on Human Rights Act.
I see. So you try that to a jury and get a verdict, and then if we affirm and say that sheriff has power to dismiss her because he didn't test, then it disappears without an appeal.
Well, in that case, we would have to come up with some... If it's ruled that the sheriff's testing is appropriate, we would have to come up with other evidence of sex discrimination against our client. You know, maybe some kind of sexist comments or so forth, or some other evidence of sex discrimination that maybe they do uniformly apply that. But, I mean, but
you're her lawyer. You know what it was. Was it testing or was it something else?
Our main argument is the testing. But nevertheless, I mean, we haven't fully put on our case at trial on the retaliation claim. I mean, put on our evidence on the retaliation claim. And we could argue that they're just using the testing as an excuse because they're really discriminating against her based on her sex. So I'm saying it's not completely the same claim. And the retaliation claim is it's a separate claim that can stand on its own regardless of how this testing issue is resolved in any event. So really, that issue, just to kind of summarize, there's been no plea to the jurisdiction because the sheriff has never tried to dismiss all the claims. Since there's been no plea to the jurisdiction, this interlocutory appeal is improper because the sheriff can only pursue an interlocutory appeal from an order denying a plea to the jurisdiction. So the condition precedent there hasn't been fulfilled. There's no plea to the jurisdiction.
Counsel, let me ask you a different question, kind of head in a little different direction. The House Research Organization's bill analysis for this change to 51.014 says that these interlocutory orders can be appealed, include orders that grant or deny, quote, a claim that the court lacks jurisdiction, close quote. So that language in the bill report doesn't, or the bill analysis doesn't say a summary judgment motion, doesn't say a plea to the jurisdiction, it says a claim from the House side. Are you familiar with any other legislative history on the background of A8?
I'm not familiar with any other legislative history, though I will cite to a case cited by this court. I know Mr. Hull and the sheriff had just at oral argument cited a few cases supporting his argument that that whole interlocutory provision is construed broadly. But this court in Steary versus DeBoard, citation is 967 Southwest 2nd 352, 1998 case. In that case, that was the plaintiffs had filed a shareholder derivative claim, and the trial court struck the claim, and the plaintiffs tried to pursue an interlocutory appeal on the ground that the trial court refused to certify a class. And the plaintiff's argument was that a derivative claim is the equivalent of a class action. In other words, they're trying to make a similar argument to what's being made here, which is that the sheriff is arguing that a plea to the jurisdiction is equivalent to a motion for summary judgment. And then this court in Steary said, it rejected the plaintiff's claims, and it said that appellate jurisdiction over interlocutory appeals is allowed only if the statute explicitly provides for that jurisdiction, and explicitly is the key word. The court narrowly construed that provision and said, basically, since the plain language just talks about class actions, it doesn't talk about class actions and derivative claims cannot be pursued on an interlocutory appeal. Similarly here, since the plain language says plea to the jurisdiction, it means plea to the jurisdiction, not plea to the jurisdiction and motion for summary judgment. Plus, I've already explained why there is a significant difference between their motion for partial summary judgment and a plea to the jurisdiction, in that a plea to the jurisdiction seeks to dismiss all the claims, whereas a motion for partial summary judgment, like they filed, doesn't seek to dismiss all the claims. So the policy reasons for allowing an interlocutory appeal is significant. Because, like I said, the reason for allowing a policy reason for allowing an interlocutory appeal is because you don't want the state to have to waste its resources needlessly on a trial. Whereas that policy reason doesn't exist here, since there's going to be a trial anyways in a retaliation claim. Or in any case, where the governmental entity doesn't seek to dismiss all the claims in the case.
Could plea to the jurisdiction in the statute refer generally to that method of raising subject matter jurisdiction? Because we all kind of know that pleas to the jurisdiction involve subject matter jurisdiction claims.
Well, as Your Honor pointed out when Mr. Hull was up here, those eight provisions in the interlocutory appeal provision are very specific. And the legislature could have easily put in there, and motion for summary judgment by saying specifically, plead to the jurisdiction. The plain language is control. And this court in Sterry said that unless the statute explicitly provides for appellate jurisdiction over interlocutory appeals, there is no appellate jurisdiction over interlocutory appeals. So you just got to go back to the plain language. Unless there's some clear evidence of legislative intent saying that the legislature didn't intend to allow interlocutory appeals from denials of summary judgment. In the absence of that, the plain language is controlling it, and the plain language says plea to the jurisdiction.
Let me ask you, the petitioner's brief says that the trial court expressly denied defendant's challenge to the jurisdiction. And the order was under tab C, as cited in the briefing. It's the order signed March 4th, 2002. It says, after considering the evidence and the legal arguments, this court grants defendant's motion in part. There's a part there that says, and denies part of it, but that's marked out by the trial court. So there's no language in this order that says any part of defendant's motion was denied. Is this March 4th, 2002, the order that you all are basing your assertion that the trial court denied the challenge to jurisdiction? Is there another order?
There's another order. I believe the sheriff is relying on, it would be tab B of the sheriff's brief on the merits.
Well, he says he's relying on tab C. Tab B seems to relate to the interpretation of the order. Tab C does seem to be the, at least in its proposed original form, and in the marked up form, the order that relates to the jurisdiction challenge. Do you know which one directly goes to the jurisdiction challenge? My problem is, and maybe I should ask petitioner's counsel, but since you're up here too on the same issue, I wondered which order expressly denied the challenge to the jurisdiction.
I guess I'm kind of arguing for Mr. Hull, but I guess his point would be that by awarding us relief, the trial court implicitly stated that it has jurisdiction and denied their challenge to jurisdiction. So by the tab B, which grants us relief, implicitly denies their challenge to the jurisdiction. But turning on like I said, I think this case can be resolved just on the rule that the trial court has jurisdiction over any claim against the government entity, then interlocutory appeal should not be allowed. But setting that aside for a minute and just turning on to the next issue, which is regardless of whether or not the Court of Appeals erred on that plea to the jurisdiction issue, and I don't think they did from what I've just said, but regardless of whether they did, the Court of Appeals correctly held that the Civil Service Commission did not have exclusive jurisdiction over this claim in this case. And there's really two reasons for that. One is that the local government code doesn't say that the commission has exclusive jurisdiction over this type of claim. And the second point, which I want to talk about a little bit more, and which is pretty much what my brief talks about, which is that the Civil Service Commission has, in essence, already ruled that Jeannie Long does not need to take any physical tests before returning to work because there is nothing in the order that says she needs to.
Well, when it already ruled, did it have exclusive jurisdiction then?
Yes.
But now it doesn't have exclusive jurisdiction anymore.
Because it's already ruled. That's my argument. I'm saying by the fact, since the order doesn't, if a purported requirement is not in the order, then Ms. Long does not need to satisfy that purported requirement in order
to. And so if it had ruled, it would have exclusive jurisdiction.
Yes. Yes. I mean, the commission ordered that she be returned to work, period.
So when she returns to work, she doesn't have to clock in?
Well, the order, the district court order
says... She doesn't have to clock in, she doesn't have to check in with her supervisor or anything, because they ordered her back to work. She doesn't have to do any of the normal requirements that people have to do when they go back to work.
Well, no, the tab B to the sheriff's brief, which is the trial court's order, says, quote, once returned to work, this order does not govern the employer-employee relationship, end quote.
So why did she go immediately, why did she show up at work and say, I want to work, and then if they wouldn't let her, then she goes files another grievance with the commission saying, they won't let me work without tests?
Well, attached to our plaintiff's first amended petition is a letter from the sheriff saying to our office on her behalf saying that she is not allowed to return to work unless she first completes the physical test.
Then why didn't she go to the commission to get that resolved?
My argument is it's not her burden to do that. The plain language of the commission's order favors her.
What if we disagree with that and we decide that this is truly ambiguous, that the order is silent, then who should have done what?
I would argue that's a primary jurisdiction issue, which means that maybe this court could say, okay, well, maybe she should have, maybe the commission, you know, in the best case scenario, maybe the commission should have had an opportunity to rule on this issue. But primary jurisdiction is not a jurisdictional issue, as this court explained
then what should have happened? Shouldn't the trial court have abated and told her to go back to the commission?
If it's a primary jurisdiction issue, then that would be like a discretionary thing for the trial judge to say, well, yeah, I think you should have gone to the commission first instead of coming directly to me. But that's not really an issue for this court, because this court on this interlocutory appeal can only rule on jurisdictional issues, because they can only appeal from the order denying a plea to the jurisdiction.
Well, then I don't understand your answers to me. I thought I asked you if the commission originally had exclusive jurisdiction over this issue, and you said yes.
Yes.
And I said, and if the commission didn't rule, therefore it had exclusive jurisdiction. And I thought you said yes.
Yes, and I'm saying they did rule in our favor.
Right. And then I said, but what if they didn't? And you said then the commission would have exclusive jurisdiction, or did I misunderstand you?
Well, I guess I'm wondering what you mean by what if they didn't rule. As I read the order, they did rule that she does not need to take the physical test. Because
okay, but they didn't rule. It didn't come up, they didn't rule. If you went back in there and said, motion to clarify, did you rule on this or not, they say no. Do they have exclusive jurisdiction or not? And I thought that was what I asked you, and I thought you said yes. And now I think you said they only have primary jurisdiction, and I don't understand how what started out exclusive jurisdiction becomes primary jurisdiction.
Well, once they make a ruling, like in this case, then the trial court has primary jurisdiction means the trial court has concurrent jurisdiction. Once they make a ruling, like in this case, then both the commission and the trial court presumably have concurrent jurisdiction to enforce that order. In other words, that's what the issue in this case that resulted in this lawsuit is. We're trying to enforce the commission's order.
But back to the Chief Justice's question. If we think they didn't rule, if we think the commission then did not rule on this issue,
okay,
then what?
I see what you're saying. I guess I will amend my answer to then say that that's really a primary jurisdiction point. That the trial court, that's a more prudential issue. In other words, the trial court possibly could have said, well, as a matter of discretion, I'm going to order that you go back to the commission and talk to them first, but that's not really a jurisdictional issue. This is a primary jurisdiction.
Where did the commission get the exclusive jurisdiction in the first place that you say it had? Is there a statute or a rule?
Well, the local government code says that the commission has the authority to implement rules regarding discipline and so forth. So that is the procedure. Initially, if an employee of the sheriff's department wants to challenge a disciplinary action, the only place to go is the commission. They can't go straight to the district court.
Is that under union contract? Is that under statutes?
It's under the statute, the local government code section. It's one.
I know where it is. It grants them the power to make rules. Where's the part that says you have to go? I was assuming that was a union contract.
I believe it's in the commission's rules. It must be under the regulations issued by the commission under rule number 12. It must say if an employee wants to challenge a disciplinary action, the employee must take these steps, and with a hearing at the commission. So, yeah, the only way for an employee to initially challenge a disciplinary action is through the commission. Then once the commission makes the ruling, as it did in this case, then to enforce that ruling, which is what we did here, the district court has jurisdiction to enforce the ruling. And just to argue again that in case the court is thinking about ruling that the commission does not rule on the physical testing issue, my point on that is that we'd all agree that Jeannie Long does not need to run a marathon before returning to work. Now, why do we all agree with that? Because it's not in the order. It's not in the commission's order. The commission's order does not say that she...
Well, assume we disagree with you. What should we do?
Well,
assume we say the order's silent. What happens should happen next?
Well, I'm saying even if the order is silent, now I agree. The order, by the plain language of the order, is silent. But I'm saying silence means she does not need to take the test.
What if we disagree with you?
Okay.
We say testing is still, we don't know.
Okay. And then, of course, the first argument I was making, this case should still be dismissed because interlocutory appeals are not allowed.
So, I mean, we disagree with you on that.
Okay. Well, the local government code does not say that the commission has exclusive jurisdiction over this type of claim. And then the court appeal, that's what the court appeals ruled. And they're relying on this court's decision in Subaru, which basically was interpreting the motor vehicle code and relied on the word exclusive in that statute as giving that entity.
You're saying they did have exclusive jurisdiction over disciplinary matters.
Initially. And we fulfilled that, Gina Lunk fulfilled that by getting an order from the commission. Once the commission made the ruling, the commission no longer had exclusive.
Let's assume she was reinstated in Stanter when that order came out, the commission's order. Then the department says you still have to take the test. What jurisdiction does the commission have at that point to say yes, no?
So you're saying that after the commission ordered that she be returned to work, then she goes back to work, and then on her first day of the job, they tell her you have to take a test.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then the commission's order has been satisfied at that point. It's out of the picture. She's just like any other employee. If she wants to, if she refuses to follow an order, they could discipline her or fire her. And if she wants to challenge that as being, you know, they're treating her differently than other employees, she'll have to go through the whole commission process again and challenge it through the commission rather than going to district court or anything. She'd have to pursue another hearing for the commission. But at that, the point is, in that situation, the commission's order hasn't been complied with because she's been returned to work. She was never allowed to return to work in this case, so the order was never complied with.
The sheriff's policy is that if you're off more than 12 months, then to return, you have to take the test, correct?
Yes, but the order...
So let me ask this. Sheriff presumably didn't know what type of, let's say, physical condition she was in after 12 months. Could she still perform the requirements of the job physically? So if we follow your analysis, then testing's not required. She's hired. After a day, everyone says she just can't handle the job. Test her the second day back. She fails the test. Then she's back in the same boat as if she'd been tested on day one.
Yes. Does
that make sense?
Yes. At least in that sense, the commission's order.
Does it make sense that anyone employed by the sheriff should be able to fulfill the physical requirements of doing the job?
Yes, and there's a provision that says you can be disciplined, I think, for lack of physical fitness or something along those lines.
But under my example, she gets to come back for the 2 days.
Okay, and that makes all the difference because in that sense, the commission's order has been complied with. She's been returned to work, and we have no right then to ask the district court to enforce the order because the order's been complied with. In this case, you're not ever allowed to return to work, so the commission's order was never complied with. That's why I went to the district court in the first place.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Hull, the express denial by the trial court in its order, which order is that? Where's the language, please, sir?
That was B and C, and that's an unfortunate wording on my part. I apologize. It should be implied.
Implied from the order under tab C.
Yeah, C and B together, you have to read them together. They were signed on the same day. The trial judge considered both parties' motions on the same day.
How do you respond to the argument that the retaliatory discharge claim is still at the trial court and no one has contested jurisdiction over that?
You know, those cases you cited, Your Honor, go back to the case I talked about earlier.
Well, but first of all, let me ask you this. Do you agree with this assessment that no challenge has been made or no motion made as to that claim? It is still pending in the trial court.
I do agree with that. Under those cases that he cited, cite back to a case called Spear versus Stober. It's a case I talked about earlier with the plea and abatement and the plea to the jurisdiction. That's a case from this court, 685 Southwest 2nd, 22. The entire opinion is contained in page 23. It's cited in the brief. But what the Supreme, what this court was doing in that case, this court was explaining the difference between the result of a plea and abatement and a plea to the jurisdiction. This court simply said sustaining a plea to the jurisdiction requires dismissal. Sustaining a plea and abatement requires that the claim be abated until removal of the same impediment or of some impediment. This court didn't say all claims have to go or some claims can't go. It didn't say anything like that. And I followed up on this and I looked at these cases he cited, and this court has never addressed that issue. And to me it seems kind of silly. You can talk about policy reasons, but I think it's kind of silly for a court to deny an interlocutory appeal right and instead say trial court, even though you probably don't have jurisdiction over these claims, you do have jurisdiction over one claim, therefore we want you to go ahead and try them all. Now you could say, well, more effective, money, I'm trying to think of the word, efficient. But the problem is you're asking a trial court to try a claim that you know is without jurisdiction to try, and therefore it's like an advisory opinion that this court can't issue. I can't see any reason why a trial court should be able to try a case when it doesn't have jurisdiction over it. And that's the point of the interlocutory appeal statute. The point I'm trying to make is this court has never held that. Those cases cite back to Spear versus Stover from this court, and it does not hold that. It doesn't address that issue. It's not part of the case.
What if we were to conclude that the commission's order entitled Ms. Long to go back to work the very next day? It was silent as to testing, so that was something that you could require of her. If she didn't like it, she could go back and go through the grievance process. But we nevertheless concluded that she was entitled to be returned to work the day after the commission's order. Where does that leave your case?
She was entitled to go right back to work, Your Honor. First duty assignment.
Did you start cutting her paycheck?
Yeah. First duty assignment was start taking the test.
That was 20 days later. More than 20 days later.
Well, I guess that's true. Ironically, though, with the 20-day notice, she didn't respond. I mean, the point is, I don't think the equity is on her.
Your letter said you don't show up until this date, and when you show up, have this packet, and you will take a physical test. If we construed the commission's order as allowing her to return to work the very next day, and you didn't allow her to return to work, and that the testing issue could be resolved by the commission at a later date, where does that leave your case today?
I don't think it changes anything, Your Honor. She never asked to go back to work on the 8th. The letter went out on the 7th, I believe, 6th or 7th of September. She never asked to go back. She never responded to any of the letters that we sent her asking her to come back. She didn't call and say, reschedule my appointment. She didn't do anything. She just didn't show up. And all of a sudden, she filed suit November 13th, 2.5 months later, and says, I'm suing you. Her first assignment back to work was to take the test. And she is paid for those tests while she's taking those tests. She is paid as an employee.
Did y'all cut her a check?
Yes.
And that's in the record. Did she pay
that
her?
Is not in the record.
But she was paid after this order came out.
Yes,
for how long? How long?
Well, none of that's in the record, but she started the process and didn't finish it by her choice, and I don't know how much the money was, how much the check was.
She started what process? Sorry.
The testing process, Your Honor.
She started the testing process?
Yes, after these orders came out, Your Honor.
Is that in the record, or is that not in the record either?
That's not in the record, Your Honor. All this happened after these orders came out and the interlocutory appeal was taken.
Counsel, 158.037 says an employee who owned a final decision by the commission may appeal by filing a petition in the district court.
Yes, Your Honor.
And further says the district court may order reinstatement, payment of back pay, or other appropriate relief. How do you square that statute with your exclusive jurisdiction argument?
Well, under the other appellate, which I think starts with 158.038, the review of the commission's decision is substantial evidence, and it tracks the APA, the Administrative Procedure Act, with the 6 or 7 different grounds, you know, arbitrary and capricious and this and that. So actually, the district court's relief is very limited, and it has to find under those circumstances, just as it would under the Administrative Procedure Act. So actually, it tracks the typical state commission.
So from your standpoint, if the district court follows those requirements, it does have jurisdiction to consider the relief the commission ordered?
As far as exempting her from the testing?
Modifying the order, entering a different order, or other appropriate relief.
Yeah, to be honest with you, Honor, I don't believe that statute's ever been interpreted. I mean, there's an argument to be made for that.
Well,
I'm not prepared to argue one way or the other.
It says the court may order reinstatement, payment of back pay, or other appropriate relief. If we agree with you that the Court of Appeals had jurisdiction under 51.014A8. Is our appropriate judgment to remand this to the Court of Appeals to consider the other issues?
I believe, Your Honor, because you have jurisdiction over one issue, you can take jurisdiction over the rest. In other words, it's up to the court. The court can remand it and ask the Court of Appeals to consider it in the first instance. But because it's a jurisdictional issue, it's a legal issue, and this court is perfectly capable of deciding the legal issue in the first instance.
But in order to take something on interlocutory appeal, there has to be a substantive conflict. You're not claiming there's a conflict of laws on the other pieces. You're just, all we're doing in this case is reviewing the Court of Appeals jurisdiction to decide those issues, right?
No, Your Honor. There is a conflict as well as reviewing the Court of Appeals decision. There are seven cases that say that an appeal under A8 is permissible if it's filed in something other than a plea to the jurisdiction.
No, I understand on that point, but we would have jurisdiction to review that point anyway because it would fall within our ability to review whether the Court of Appeals had jurisdiction. What I'm saying is on the other points that the Court of Appeals declined to address because it found it did not have jurisdiction, we would need a conflict on those issues to be able to take those up, wouldn't we?
No, Your Honor. No. You could take supplemental jurisdiction. I'm not sure the exact word. But if you have jurisdiction over one issue in a case, you can take jurisdiction over all. I do cite that in the brief, but I'm very sure of that.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the arguments in today's cases, and the marshal will adjourn the court.
All right. Okay. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.